This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's proving awfully difficult to change our healthcare system and provide care for people currently uninsured. Yet, as T.R. Reid points out in his new book, all the developed countries, except the U.S., have decided that every human being has a basic right to healthcare. Reid says we can bring about fundamental change by borrowing ideas from foreign models of healthcare. His conclusion comes from personal experience. He spent years as a foreign correspondent for the Washington Post and lived with his family in three continents. For his new book, he went on a global quest searching for solutions to two healthcare problems. The first, our nation's healthcare system. The second, his bad shoulder. He took his shoulder to doctors around the world, seeking alternatives to the risky surgery that was recommended for him in the U.S. T.R. Reid's new book is called The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. T.R. Reid, welcome back to Fresh Air. One of the main arguments that we're hearing from critics of reform is that this would be socialized medicine. You point out in your book that that argument was actually created by a PR firm in the 1940s. Can you describe what happened then?
Yeah, Harry Truman wanted to provide universal health care in 1947. The American Medical Association, the doctors, hired a PR firm who invented the term socialized medicine. Nobody knew what it meant. But I think the idea was if you wanted to provide health care to your sick neighbor, you were a commie. And, you know, during the Cold War, that was a powerful argument. The amazing thing is it's still a powerful argument. I don't know that anybody can define socialized medicine, but nobody seems to like it except, Terry, when Americans get government-run medicine, they really like it. The VA, the Native American Health Service, and Medicare are the three most popular health care systems in America, all run by government.
Now, you've broken down Western healthcare systems into four different categories. I think it would be really helpful for all of us to understand what some of the options are out there, how other countries do it. Let's talk about those systems. Let's start with what is often called the William Beveridge model, because he's the person who inspired the British National Health Service. And you describe the British National Health Service as probably what's closest to what Americans have in mind when they talk about socialized medicine. So give us an overview of that system.
Yeah, well, in the Beveridge model, taking care of people's health is government's job, just like picking up the trash or putting out fires or running the public library. When you need the service, you get it, and you don't pay there. You pay for it in taxes. It's a government service. About 97% of the people in Britain and Spain, Italy, New Zealand, those are also Beveridge model countries, never get a doctor bill in their life. They go their whole life and never get a hospital bill. How do you do that? You assume that it's government's job to keep people healthy. I would say that's socialized medicine. Government owns the hospitals. It employs a lot of the doctors and nurses. And government buys the pills. Government pays the bills. Yeah, I'd say that's socialized medicine. But, you know, you get a lot of benefits out of it. For one thing, it's so simple administratively. You know, the billing office, a British hospital with 900 beds. And I said to the guy, where's the billing office? Oh, yeah, it's one drawer in my secretary's desk over there, which she opens once a month to send some record to the government. It's just so much simpler. There's one set of rules. So those systems really work. And, you know, our family lived in Britain. And guess what happens, Terry? Your kid has an earache. The doctor comes to your house. She goes back and sees your child and says, I believe it's otitis media. I gave her a penicillin jab. Your kid feels better. The parent feels better. And then guess what? She walks out the door. No bill. No three-month in fight with the insurance company over who's going to pay the bill. So I found a lot to like in Britain. For our family, it worked well.
Are there insurance companies in England?
Yeah. Because the NHS covers almost everything.
NHS is the National Health Service.
The National Health Service, I'm sorry, yeah, the free service. There are private insurance plans that will cover things they don't cover, like Botox or breast enlargement. Private health insurance will get you to the top of the waiting list faster, although now, because Tony Blair spent so much money, the waiting lists are a lot shorter. It'll get you a private room in the hospital. About 10% of the people in Britain have private insurance, but it only accounts for about 3% of the money spent on healthcare. When anything serious has to happen, this is interesting. People go to the public hospital. I had a really good friend who had a baby. She had private insurance. And I said, well, you're going to go to a private doctor? Oh, no, 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 no. For my baby, that's too important. I'm trust the NHS.
So what about the question of choice? Can you go to any doctor you want to? Can you see a specialist if you want to?
Britain has a gatekeeper system. You have to go to the general practitioner first, just like in a lot of American insurance plans. You can go to any GP in the country, but most people pick the guy who's right down the street. Our doctor was two blocks away, so when we called her, she could get down to our house in an hour. But if you want to go to an orthopedist or a cardiac surgeon, then you have to go to the GP first and get a recommendation. And when we lived there, well, we came home, 4 years ago, there were still some waiting lines to see specialists. It was tough, but I think those waiting lists are way down, as I said, because Blair and Brown have spent a lot of money.
On the health insurance system.
Yeah. One of the ways, you know, they have that thing in Britain on Wednesday where the prime minister stands up in parliament and the other party insults him and shouts questions at him. And one of the most standard questions is, a woman in my constituency has been waiting 4 weeks to see a doctor. This is outrageous. And that happens. And then the answer that the prime minister always gives is, well, obviously, the gentleman opposite wants us to see us institute for-profit American-style corporate medicine. This we will never do, you know, and they never will.
Is that the worst? Is that the worst thing that you can say? We're going to institute American-style corporate medicine?
All over the world, people say that. If you complain about health care, they say, well, you want to move to America? You think that's better? Everywhere I went, people had this kind of smug superiority. They know that we let people die and go bankrupt by the thousands in our healthcare system, and they don't do that, so they feel better. Person in the health ministry in Canada, you know, they're kind of understated people in Canada, said to me, you know, we don't go around chanting we're number one like some countries I know, but there are two areas where we're better than the states: hockey and healthcare.
Now, what about the question of choice? You quote the British health minister as saying, we cover everybody, but we don't cover everything. So what are some of the things that the British National Health Service won't cover?
Well, I'm a man of a certain age, and in America, a man like me would get a prostate cancer test, a blood test for prostate cancer. And I was really friendly with my GP in Britain and said to him, hey, I should get this test. I get it at least once a year in America. He said, no, we don't think it's cost effective. So I'm thinking, hey, if it finds cancer in me, it's pretty cost effective. I like that. But they were thinking of an entire society. And of course, as we now know, the American researchers, too, have now concluded that that's not a useful test.
Is there anything that you would describe as rationing, the kind of rationing that Americans are really afraid of?
Every country rations health care, Terry. There's no question about that. And, they do some of it at the end of life. They limit some of the procedures. They limit this drug Herceptin for breast cancer. They only allow that in certain cases. That's certainly true in Britain, but it's true everywhere. Every country rations health care. This is not a nice thing to say, but the United States rations health care. The distinction is we ration differently from everybody else. I think this is important. In the other countries, they have sort of a basic floor of care that everybody has access to. And the result is nobody dies for lack of a doctor. In America, some people get everything. The ceiling is the sky, you know, kind of thing, and get it right away with no waiting. But a lot of people don't have access to care. So that's how we ration. We ration by cutting off access for tens of millions of people, and no other country rations health care that way.
Okay, and here's another question about the British National Health Service. You mentioned that there is kind of rationing at the end of life. So what are some of the procedures or some of the things that are, you know, typically done at the end of life in the United States that wouldn't be done under the National Health Service in England?
That's really hard to say. I think there's an age cutoff in Britain, and it's kind of hard to figure out what that is. I think it varies by region, after which they won't give you kidney dialysis. That's a fairly expensive and intrusive procedure, and at age 89, 90 or something, they won't do it. But that's true in some plans in America, too. So this business about throwing grandma off the cliff, I think, frankly, is baloney, and I'll tell you why. There's a standard statistic, Terry, in healthcare. healthy life expectancy at age 60. How long are you going to live on the day you turn 60? All the other rich democracies have a longer life expectancy at age 60 than 60-year-old Americans have. So they can't be throwing seniors off the cliff over there. They're keeping them alive longer than ours are.
Let's look at the French model, because you seem particularly interested in the French system. And I think that was rated the number one healthcare system by the World Health Organization study that ranked countries around the world. So
yeah, everybody in France knows this. They're thrilled about this. The World Health Organization did rate them number one. And, you know, I went there. I can see why. It's a very good healthcare system. But in contrast, you remember we said the British system, the government provides the care and the government pays for the care. These Bismarck models on the continent of Europe and in Japan, they're all private. They're private docs, private hospitals, and mainly private insurance plans.
So are these insurance companies in this model that France has, are they for-profit companies like our for-profit insurance companies?
No country that has insurance companies lets insurance companies make a profit on basic health insurance. And they have pretty strict rules. I mean, this is nice insurance. In Germany, for example, there are about 200 insurance companies. It's not single payer. I want to make that point. 200 insurance companies. Anybody in Germany can buy any of the 200 company plans. If you don't like your insurance, guess what? You can drop it, shift to the next guy, and the new guy can't raise your premium. Now, that's, you know, more choice than anybody in America has. These companies have to cover everybody. They have to pay every claim. They don't have all those people going through saying, sorry, we don't cover that. In many countries, if you're stressed and the doctor says you need a weekend at the spa, the insurance has to pay for that. That's in the law. Generally, they have to pay in a short period of time. In France, the doctor has to be paid within 3 days. Get this. In Switzerland, if the insurance company doesn't pay your claim in 5 days, your next month's premium is free.
Wow.
That's pretty good health
that's
insurance.
Amazing.
Yeah, exactly. People actually like their health insurance companies in those countries. And, you know, this business in America where we have the in-network deal or you have to get pre-authorization. In France, this is true in Germany, Japan, any doctor, any clinic, any chiropractor, anybody in the entire country, you choose them, you go, and insurance has to pay the bill within 2 weeks or so. Pretty good insurance.
I'm trying to understand how a nonprofit insurance company would operate. I think there's some of them in the United States, but for the most part, we in the United States think of insurance companies as companies that kind of bet against you in a way, that they're betting that they're going to make money off of you because your health is going to be good or not so bad or whatever. And if the odds are against you, they're going to try to drop you or not insure you in the first place. But it's a gamble. The whole insurance industry in America, it's gambling. And you sometimes lose, as the insured, you lose the gamble. So what's the difference between a for-profit American-style insurance company and a French non-profit-style insurance company?
Well, all over the world, health insurance is non-profit except the U.S. And as a matter of fact, when health insurance started in the U.S., the original Blue Cross and Blue Shields in every state were non-profit, and they operated fine. The concept is more like the taxes you pay to operate the fire department in your town. Most people will never have a fire at their house, and therefore the fire department makes enough money from everybody to put out the ones that do happen. In those countries, the insurance companies are basically charities. They're community organizations, and they have one goal in life, and that is to keep people healthy. That's what they're for. And the reason for that is those countries have all decided that there's a basic conflict between making a profit for investors and covering people's health. The last country, as I say in the book, that allowed health insurance companies to make a profit on the basic coverage was Switzerland. And guess what? In the mid-90s, the Swiss companies were copying our companies. They finally decided, well, why should we sell a policy to anybody who's sick? They might make a claim and cost us money. So they started turning people down for pre-existing conditions. Switzerland got to the point, now fasten your seatbelt, Terry, 5% of the people in Switzerland couldn't get insurance. And that was a scandal. That was unthinkable. Well, we're at 16% today, but that was not acceptable in Switzerland. So they had a national referendum took the profit out of insurance and said that everybody has to have a policy.
So in the model that we're talking about, that France and Germany, Belgium, Switzerland, and some other countries follow, do you have your choice of insurance companies, or is there just one national company that you buy from?
In some countries like France and Japan, you get the insurance that applies to your industry or your company or your region, and that's it. But some countries, Germany, Switzerland, Germans can choose any of 200 health insurance plans, and the plans do compete, even though they can't make a profit. Now, why do they do that? Well, one reason is the more members, the more customers the plan has, the more money its executives make, so that's a reason to compete. In Switzerland, it's interesting. The same company that sells the nonprofit basic health insurance plan also sells life insurance and fire insurance, and they sell this kind of supplemental insurance to cover breast enlargement or hair replacement. So they try to win you by being really good nonprofit health insurance companies, and then you say, oh, that's good, I'll buy my fire insurance there too. And they're all making more money because they use the basic health insurance as a way to bring in customers.
When you say they're making more money, do you think that the salaries of insurance executives in the countries you're talking about now compare to the multi-million dollar salaries of insurance CEOs in the United States?
Oh, no. But nobody makes American insurance CEO kind of salaries.
One of the things I loved about your description of the French healthcare system is the healthcare card that everybody carries. Why don't you describe what makes that so special?
The carte vitale, yeah. French doctors don't make a lot. They do fine. You know, they're good middle-class people, but they're not rich. And their offices are Spartan. You know, they don't have National Geographic sitting on the table. There's just a plain white waiting room and then the doctor's office. But what's missing in all doctor's offices in France is the files and files of patient records, and there's no billing office. And I said to this doc I spent some time with, where's your billing office? He said, oh, this would be ridiculous. I don't make enough money to pay somebody to do the billing, but he doesn't have to. Here's what happens. The patient comes in, out of her pocket, she pulls this green credit card. It's called the carte vitale. He puts that in a reader on his desk, and her entire medical record shows up on the screen. And he chats with her about her problem. He's typing down what she's got wrong. And he says to her, well, I think I'm going to prescribe a course of antibiotic, and I want you to take two a day for 2 weeks. And he's typing all that up. And then he's finished with her. He turns to me and he says, ah, Monsieur Reed, please watch. He hits one key on his computer, and the entire bill has gone to her insurance company. He's going to be paid in 3 days. And she's going to get her copay back from the insurance company within 2 weeks. Done. No paper.
And the next time she goes to a different doctor, he can put her card in the reader and see what this doctor had prescribed and what this doctor
thought. That's right. He'll say, oh, did that other antibiotic work for this condition when you had it 2 years ago? Yeah, it's perfect. They find you. Your record, you can actually see on this card, there's a little gold chip, as you saw in the book, where your health records are. So doesn't this raise privacy problems? And I asked that in the health ministry. But he says they've never had a problem with identity theft or people stealing records because this is encrypted, and I guess the encryption's pretty good.
Now, Japan has borrowed this model that France has. And you say that in Japan there's good access to fine doctors and lots of choice, but the system is overstretched and it's pinching pennies. So how does that affect the healthcare of Japanese people?
Well, their healthcare is fabulous. They have the longest lived and the healthiest population in the world. They have much better recovery rates from every major disease than Americans do. It's just a marvelous healthcare system. And they love going to the doctor in Japan. In Japan, on average, people go to the doctor 15 times a year. We go about 4.3 times per year in America. Average hospital stay in Japan is 36 nights. Ours is 6 nights. So they're big consumers of medicine, very, very good results, but the Japanese spend less than half as much per capita as we do. How do they do that? The answer is they're stingy. They have the stingiest pay scale of all the rich countries. Docs and hospitals just don't make much money, and the result is a lot of hospitals in Japan are now borrowing money from banks just to operate. It's really, they're under severe strain. The solution, they spend 8% of GDP on healthcare. We spend about 17%. If they raise that to 9%, they could pay all their doctors and hospitals a better wage. But so far, they've tried to resist that, but they're going to have to do it.
So that would mean just raising the taxes a little bit.
Yeah, or maybe raising the insurance premium or something.
We've talked a little about Britain's National Health Service. We've looked at the French model, which is used in Germany and Japan and several other countries. Let's look at the model in Canada, which you describe as the National Health Insurance model. What's the basics of that model?
You remember in Britain, government provides the care and government pays for the care. And in Germany, the providers and the payers are private. The Canadian model is a blend. They have private docs and private hospitals, but the payment system is public. It's one big government system. Actually, it's 14. There's one for each province. Everybody pays. In some provinces, it's a tax, and some provinces, it's called a premium. You pay in every month, just like we pay Social Security tax and Medicare tax. You go to the doctor, and it's free. And this really works pretty well. The docs are private, and they just bill the government. You don't get a bill, and this means anybody can go. It means nobody with an acute condition in Canada dies for lack of health care, as happens in America. The flaw with the Canadian system is, to save money, they've cut back sharply on the number of specialists, on operating rooms, on scanning machines. So if it's anything that's not acute, they keep you waiting. I mean, they keep you waiting weeks or months. You know, I have this bum shoulder, and I said to this wonderful doctor I was with in Canada, "I got a bum shoulder. It really hurts me." He said, "Yeah, I better send you an orthopedist." "How long would it take?" He said, "Oh, 10 or 12 months."
Whoa.
12 months? 12 months. It hurts. It hurts every morning when I wake up, and I got to wait 12 months to get treatment. This guy says, "Oh, I didn't say treatment. No, it would be 10 months or so to get a consultation. If he wants to do anything, it'll be 6 more months before an operating room comes up." So this is just a choice they made. It's not a function of their system, because other countries that have the same system don't have waiting times. But it's absolutely true that Canada keeps people waiting. They did it to save money.
Can you get supplemental insurance and through that jump ahead of the line?
Ha! That's up in the air at the moment. The Canadians are so egalitarian, the Swedes did this too, that they first said, no, we have a very good health care system here, and that's where you're going to get your health care. Obviously, some people in Canada could go south to America and buy health care without waiting in the line. The number of people who do that seems to be pretty small. It's not as big as you hear in the argument in America, but some do that. But 3 years ago, was it, the Canadian Supreme Court ruled that they can't bar you from buying private insurance and going to private doctors. And this created all sorts of concern in Canada, because their big bugaboo, you know how we're all worried about socialized medicine? Their equivalent of that term, the thing they all hate, is two-tier medicine. They definitely don't want a system where rich people get better care than poor people. That would be un-Canadian. And so what they did is they tried to step up the spending on the system they have so that people can get care. And as it turns out, there are a few places in Canada where a doctor can operate privately, but not many, because the rule is if you operate in the Medicare system, in the national system, then you can't also treat people privately. So you got to be a doc in a pretty rich neighborhood to have enough private customers to make a living.
Let's look briefly at the fourth model that you write, the fourth and final model that you write about in your book, The Healing of America. And this is the out-of-pocket model, which you can sum up pretty quickly.
Yeah, and that's the most common model in the world, because it's only the 40 or 50 richest countries that really have a healthcare system. In all the other countries in the world, maybe 150 countries, here's the rule. If you can pay your doctor out of pocket, you get treated. If you can't pay, you stay sick or you die. That's it. Brutal, simple. It's a fact of life in most countries. Some third world countries have a big hospital in the capital city where people can line up, but out in the villages, no care. So people, if they have money, they pay in money. If they pay in potatoes, they weave a rug. In some countries, the woman brings her child in and serves as a wet nurse for the doctor's baby to pay. But basically, this is a brutal system. And if you don't have the money, tough.
Okay, so we looked at four models, and three of the four models, and these are the three models that most westernized countries use, everybody is guaranteed health care. Now, you write that in America, we have aspects of all four of the models. The three models where people are guaranteed health care, and the fourth model is if you don't have the money, you don't get the treatment. So explain how we have aspects of each of those models.
Yeah, so look, please don't tell my publisher, because I spent a lot of their money. I went all around the world for 3 years looking at these different models of healthcare. Turns out we have them all right here in the United States. If you're a Native American or a veteran, you live in Britain. They get government healthcare and government hospitals from government doctors, and you never get a bill. If you're an employed person sharing your health insurance premium with your employer, you live in Germany. That's the Bismarck model that was invented in Germany and used in many countries. If you're a senior and you buy Medicare insurance from the government and go to private doctors, you live in Canada. That's the Canadian model. As a matter of fact, the Canadian healthcare system is called Medicare. And when Lyndon Johnson provided it for our seniors in 1965, he borrowed both the model and the name from Canada. And if you're one of the tens of millions of Americans who can't get health insurance, well, you live in Malawi or Madagascar or Mali or something, because if you can pay for health insurance, you get it, or maybe you can line up at the free hospital sometime. We've got them all, and that's really the most important difference. All the other countries have decided that it's cheaper and fairer to provide one model so that everybody has the same access to the same care at the same price.
But it's not just a sense of egalitarianism that underlines your criticism of our multi-tiered healthcare system. It's also really an expensive system to maintain because there's so many different systems within it. There's so many different forms of billing. There's so many different prices. Give us an example of why that really both complicates things for doctors and patients and also makes it much more expensive.
Well, just think about it. It's just vastly simpler if there's one set of rules and one set of forms and one price or one regional price for the whole country. You know, you go to the doctor in France, and that doctor by law is required to post on the wall the price she's going to charge you for the 100 most common procedures that she does. And then the next column says how much insurance is going to pay you back, and the next column says how many days before the insurance pays you. No doctor in America could do that because they don't know what they're getting paid. They get 30 different fees for the same procedure in the same week because of all the different plans. The result is enormous administrative complexity. The American health insurance industry, you know, it's free enterprise, it's competitive. Those guys, as we said, make huge salaries. It's the least efficient payment system in the world. They spend 18 to 20% of every premium dollar on administration costs. You think of France, Terry, as a model of management efficiency. The French insurance industry spends 4% on administration. Germany, 5%. Japan, about 5%. So we are just pouring tons of money into stuff that doesn't buy anybody health care, largely because we have this hugely complicated overlapping set of systems. And that's one of the reasons all the other countries went to a single system. Another reason is if everybody's in the same system, and it doesn't have to be a single payer. Japan has 3,000 payers, but it's a coordinated system with one set of rules. If everybody's in it, then they have an economic incentive to pay for preventive care. Preventive medicine works, but it costs some money up front. And, you know, in our system, your insurance company's probably only going to cover you for 5 or 6 years till you move to the next job. It's not in their interest to spend money to keep you healthy. By the time you get sick, you're somebody else's problem.
My guest is journalist T.R. Reid, and we're talking about his new book, which is called The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. And it's about his travels around the world looking at different healthcare systems and trying to figure out what we can learn from them. Now, one of the reasons why you undertook this travelogue around the world looking at healthcare systems is that you have a bum shoulder. Tell us briefly what's wrong with your shoulder.
I fell and broke my shoulder in the U.S. Navy 30-some years ago, and the Navy fixed it at Bethesda Naval Hospital. They basically literally screwed my shoulder back together. There's a big stainless steel screw in there you can see in the x-rays. And I'm getting old now, and it's freezing up. I can't swing a golf club anymore. It hurts when I wake up in the morning. So my major quest in this book was to see if we could find a better way to do healthcare in America. But let's admit it, I also had this selfish reason maybe I could get good care for my shoulder, too. So I set out to see what I could do.
Now, in America, the doctor you saw recommended a very challenging surgical yeah. operation for you, which would have been what?
Well, he's an orthopedic surgeon, and they're confident guys. I showed him my sore shoulder, and he comes in the room with this little red metal box, and he opens it up and said, okay, here's your new shoulder. He's going to cut out the shoulder that God gave me with a saw and put in this piece of titanium and Teflon, and that's going to replace my shoulder. It'll work fine, he says. He's a good guy. I like this doctor. Well, what could go wrong? And he said, well, you know, it's major surgery. There are always some problems. Like what? He says, well, you know, death, paralysis, disease. So I said, well, maybe I'll go look around.
Okay, so let's start with England. You took your shoulder to England. And what was the advice you got there?
In Britain, that's, you know, where they invented the stiff upper lip. And to be blunt about it, my GP in Britain said, live with it. It's not destroying my life that much. I got another hand that I can reach up and change light bulbs with, you know. So he said I could send it to the orthopedic surgeon. He'd look at it. He'd say, no, not serious enough. We're not going to do the operation. And you could come back to me. We could send you to another surgeon. He'd say no. He says, I tell you what, the NHS, the National Health Service, will give you physio. That's physical therapy. And that'll help some. That'll reduce some pain. But go home and live with it. That's the advice he gave me.
Okay. Was that satisfying to you?
You know, it helped a little. It helped a little. It's not that bad. And rather than sit around and moan about it, just live your life and you can kind of forget that your shoulder hurts. Yeah, it wasn't bad.
Okay. You went to France. What kind of advice did you get there?
The guy, the orthopod in France, loved me because he threw my x-ray on that light machine they have, you know. Big smile on his face because he saw that stainless steel screw I got at Bethesda Naval Hospital. That operation was invented in France. It's called the La Target procedure. And this guy was so thrilled that I had a French operation on my American shoulder. So we did just fine. And he said that he, too, could cut out my shoulder and give me an artificial one. And that would cost, would only cost about $6,000 in France, a real bargain by American standards. He didn't think that was recommended either. He thought physical therapy and maybe some pain shots would handle me fine. If I wanted the operation, I could get it in France because they have a lot of choice, but he didn't think it made sense.
He was recommending cortisone shots?
Yeah, like, I think it was a steroid, but yeah, that's right.
Okay. You went to Japan. What did they tell you?
That was the most interesting doctor. For one thing, he was the only doctor I went to who called up my condition on a computer and read about it while I was in the room just to make sure he was right. He said in Japan they would definitely do that surgery if I wanted it, you know, replace my shoulder. He suggested monthly or bimonthly steroid shots. He said, I think you're going to get a lot of elimination of pain with that. And guess what? It worked, and it was really cheap. He suggested traditional Chinese medicine, herbal medications, and he suggested physical therapy. And he gave me the longest, widest range of anybody. And all of it was covered by Japanese insurance. And I tried. I tried the traditional Chinese medicine. I had acupuncture. And I know a lot of people get good results from acupuncture. I got nothing. I mean, it didn't hurt. It was kind of interesting to do it, but I got no gain. But Japanese insurance would pay for that, too.
I should mention that the cortisone shots and the physical therapy that the Japanese doctor recommended, you could have gotten that same advice from a lot of American doctors and had your health insurance company in America pay for it, too.
I think that's absolutely right, yeah. I mean, I went to an orthopedic surgeon, and, you know, they want to orthopedically surge. That's what they want to do. But and he's a good one. I mean, I'm sure it would have helped.
Okay, you had a very interesting experience in India.
Yeah, in India, we went to an Ayurvedic clinic. That's a 3,000-year-old Indian form of medicine. And it's herbal, and it's all about getting the prana, the flow of power in your body to flow correctly. And the way they do it, Terry, is marvelous. You lie on this dark neemwood table, and six people massage you with warm oil. I mean, it was fabulous. I did this for 5 weeks. I made a movie about it for PBS Frontline called A Second Opinion. After the massage, then the guy would take me to the shower, and these same strong masseuses would take this soap made out of green beans and wash the oil off my body. That felt great, too. It was just great. And after I made that movie, you know, trying to get my shoulder better, people would come up to me on the street and they would say one of two things. How's your shoulder? Or, I saw you naked.
So how is your shoulder? Did that massaging
it
help?
It definitely improved. I did not believe in this Ayurveda. It comes out of the Hindu religion. So while I was being treated, they made me go over to the temple and walk 3 times around Dhanvantari, the god of healing, clockwise, had to be clockwise. They made a person from the Yajnapathy department, that's astronomy, come in and read my star chart before they would treat me. I didn't buy any of this. And guess what? I got much more movement and much less pain. It definitely worked.
Well, I'm glad your shoulder has improved, and I hope it stays that way. We're having a lot of political obstacles in the United States that are slowing or preventing health care reform. You went to 2 countries that recently did remake their systems, Taiwan and Switzerland. And you say in both countries, liberal political parties stepped up the pressure for change to such a level that the conservative parties were unwilling to resist. Would you elaborate on what happened in those countries politically that enabled major healthcare reform?
Yeah, Taiwan is one of these new Asian tigers, you know, a country that got very rich. They went from about 100th in the world in GDP per capita to 20th in the world in about 15 years. And once they got there in the mid-90s, they said, well, we ought to have a rich country's healthcare system. So they did what I did in the book. They went around the world and looked at all the healthcare systems, including ours, and ended up choosing the Canadian model. And then they had this political fight to put it into effect. And the argument that the Liberal parties took was, we're a rich country now, and rich countries have a moral obligation to provide health care for everybody. The pro-business party in power resisted that for a while and then decided, no, actually, that's right. We think we do have a moral obligation as a rich country to cover everybody. So then the Conservative Party grabbed onto the idea and they put it into effect before the Liberals could win the next election. It's a pretty interesting development.
I mean, and it was so popular, reform became so popular that the Conservatives decided they wanted to take credit for it?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. They saw they couldn't stop it. Taiwan felt that they were a rich country, as important as any country in Europe or in the Americas, and rich countries have health care systems that care for everybody, which is true for all the rich countries except us.
I should mention that doctors in a lot of the countries you went to get paid much less than doctors here. But as you point out, they don't have to go as deep into debt to get their medical education as American doctors do.
Yeah, most of them go to medical school for free or for almost nothing. And their malpractice insurance premiums are much lower than in the United States. But I think a lot of it is an expectation. They don't expect to make $450,000 a year and drive a Lexus to the country club. They expect to be comfortable, middle-class people who are helping their patients and getting satisfaction in their life that way. And frankly, a lot of American doctors have that same set of expectations. They don't want to particularly be rich. They just want to treat their patients and help their community. And, of course, they see this ridiculous system we have getting in the way. So I don't think that's such a big obstacle. I think I talk to medical societies a lot, and those docs definitely would accept a system with lower payments if they had an easier way to treat their patients.
T.R. Reid, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks.
T.R. Reid is the author of the new book, The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. DIRTIC is a Providence, Rhode Island act that began as a solo project for its leader, John McCauley. Now he's gathered 3 more musicians to form a DIRTIC quartet. Rock critic Ken Tucker says DIRTIC's music remains focused on its founder's obsessions.
Life is beautiful. Beauty is a dying art. Life is wonderful. It's only
DIRTIC is an interesting work in progress. The lead singer who formed the band, John McCauley, is in his early 20s. He's precocious. He released his first album a couple of years ago, It was called War Elephant, and he played every instrument himself. Now he's put together a real Deer Tick band to flesh out his sketches of loneliness and fond self-regard.
Elbows on the windowsill, my head against the pane. Seen so many grow and die, but you forget most of their names. So fire that arrow to the great big sky and hope it never come down. Unless you're coming with it, it's better with you around.
John McCauley sings in a constipated croon, as though it pains him to try and make his voice actually hit the notes of the melodies he writes. It's a voice that carries its own inherent form of resentment, which is why the best songs on this new album, Born on Flag Day, frequently sound both angry and weary. It's an effort to find the right way to express his alienation.
How can a man feel anything when all he's ever got was sympathy? Take both your hands and put them round my neck. You're a fool for wanting everything.
There are strong elements of folk and country music in Deer Tick's music, but the attitude is classic rock and roll bratty. McCauley frequently goes on about how he feels best when he's in the most miserable part of town. He's at his best when he keeps his lyrics conversational, and at his weakest when he's straining for a hard-boiled image. When he describes, quote, a curse like a knife, it's a phrase that could have come from 1,000 other songs or 1,000 detective novels. Yet despite and because of all this, McCauley's country folk has a stubborn orneriness that keeps you listening.
Well, I'll walk away to the moon tonight and cut through the air with a curse like a knife. And it can float around and I can do what I like. There's no good place in town, but I feel all right, all right.
Deer Tick can actually be pretty charming and endearing, especially when the band tries to approximate the half-century-old rock, country, and rockabilly that McCauley clearly loves and rips off with as much brazen gusto as he can muster. I suspect that if John McCauley really wants to make a go of this Deer Tick thing, he'll have to come up with a subject other than his own discontent. The music is already there and solid, a frequently fierce melding of the Hank Williams-era country music he loves unironically. Even better is his own original take on how folk rock should sound in these hard times. If he takes more firm control over his wayward talent for narrative, I'll bet the next Deer Tick album will shake off the doldrums and take off like a rocket.
Ken Tucker reviewed the new album by Deer Tick, which is called Born on Flag Day.